Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and this is episode number 512 of the Bold and Brave Her podcast. And today I'm joined by, I love to call them, a repeat offender. Yep, he's been on before, and that is Dr. Jeffrey Hall. And Jeff is a professor of communication studies at the University of Kansas and a visiting scholar at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law. And last time he was on, we talked about technology and relationships with one of his fabulous books relating through technology. Now he's got a new one, and he threatened me with this about a year ago, saying it's coming out, and I could not wait. And this book is going to blow your mind, because now you have new words. And one of the biggest new words is, what is it? The social biome. Jeff, welcome on back. And what in heaven's name is a social biome?
Well, I am so glad. Thank you for having me on again. As a repeat offender, you never know where they're going to be invited back.
That's right. It's either a promise or a threat.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So what, the social biome, that's the coolest term.
Yeah. So the social biome came from this idea that we are defined by the patterns of the social interactions we have on a daily level. These are your close friends, your romantic partners, but these are also the people that you see on the street, the people who you interact with at the cafe, the people that you see at work. So the social biome is that interdependent web of sociality that we have that follows us throughout our entire days, and that we create and the actions that we take on, but we also are receptive to, depending on how other people treat us, the kind of opportunities we have to create connection and to kind of create sort of a sense of intimacy. But it's something that is a constant evolving, constantly growing ecology of sociality in our days.
We talk about ecosystems all the time. Every time we say the word ecosystem, I want to go out into a forest. And so we're kind of used to that in a big way. And then all of a sudden, the iome started showing up. And so I think of the gut microbiome, right, and the dermatome and the brain's connectome. And it goes on and on. Social biome. So I'm trying to envision what that actually looks like. So this is something you call a unique ecosystem of everyday communication. Go deeper.
Yeah. So one way we like to think about this when we are relationship scholars, so this kind of idea of studying people's relationships kind of in everyday life goes all the way back into the 80s. And a lot of times, each one of those ways of interacting was separated by certain people. So your friendship interactions, your romantic relationship interactions, your workplace interactions. But very few ways of looking at it thought about the idea that we're built from interactions with all kinds of people, all sort of different levels. So with the gut microbiome, we think about what is the individual unit of analysis. It actually comes down to the biology of our gut microbiome, right? Bacteria that live inside of us and change everything from our cognition to our health and our changes by what we eat, but it also makes it possible for us to digest the food that we take in. Similarly, when we think about the social biome, we think about the idea that rather than it being separated by a friend or a romantic partner or workplace, that all of those moments of interaction are all kind of the unit of analysis. So our original metaphor was the idea that you could almost like look at a little petri dish of a person's like daily interaction and know a heck of a lot about their overall social health and well-being.
Huh. Okay. So we all inhabit our own unique communication ecosystem.
Exactly.
So there are people who give you the silent treatment. Oh, that's a bad thing. And there are other people who you just can't like stop, you know, enough already. And then there are others with whom you have the richest communication, so deep, wise people in your life, people who mentor and guide you. So, you know, loved ones and acquaintances, coworkers, neighbors, customers, clerks, complete strangers. So this is the ecosystem we live in.
You got it.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So can we get it just right? Can we make all of this just perfect? Come on now. We're all very achievement oriented. Well, most of us anyway, and want to be able to get it right. I mean, What is that about? It doesn't sound like it's going to be a good experience if I'm just walking around freaking out if I'm getting it right.
That's actually a big message of the book, is that the idea that there's only one way, there's only one way to have a healthy, nourished social biome is just not true. There are many paths. There are many ways of actually building a network of connections that we have with one another that makes us healthier. And in fact, one of the ideas we really work on in this book is there is such a thing as doing too much. So if you have too many relationships, you have too many social interactions, you could feel overwhelmed. You're taking on too much emotional load from other folks. Your social energy resources are depleted. So you just cannot give the kind of attention you need to the people who matter the most in your life. So trying to have a perfect sense of communication is something we work very hard in this book to kind of step away from. So rather than a maximizing tendency, we really want to have more of a balanced approach to what do we actually want to achieve. So let me give you an example I think that actually applies here.
Please do.
So if you're a type of person, let's say that you're in a romantic relationship and you're really happy with your partner, chances are if you've just met recently, you've probably cut off a lot of the time you used to spend with your friends. So some of the research on this is pretty funny. It goes all the way back to the 80s. And it found that basically when people fall in love, they've reduced the amount of time that they spend with their friends by about 60% from what they did prior to
that. Oh, I was thinking 90%. You know, but
right. It just plummets off, right? So yeah. In some sense, what they've done is they've tightened their circle. They've made it really, really tight around this one person that they're falling in love with or they're really close to. And as a consequence, they're neglecting other relationships in their life. Let me give you another example. So let's say that you're a kind of person who's achievement oriented and you're spending 12, 14 hours a day at work. You might have really great network of people at work that you can count on, confidants, maybe even friends at work. But most of your social energy is being taken up doing this kind of work. But you can find yourself over time, you've totally starved every relationship in your life. You haven't made time for love. You haven't made time for family. You haven't made time for friends. And what's interesting is this story actually comes from the Surgeon General's warning about what happened to him when he was very achievement oriented. And he ends up writing a book about loneliness. So we know that there are lots of ways to make it more difficult to be able to kind of balance our approaches. And some of those things come from good things like falling in love, getting a new job, graduating from school, having a child, all of which can actually act like an antibiotic and totally change our gut microbiome. We have to rebuild it. In the same way that these good events can actually destroy your social biome and you have to regrow it, things that are also harmful or hurtful can also shock your social biome and make it much harder, such as divorce, such as losing a job, such as having to quickly, you know, redeploy if you're in the military. These things pull you out of that network of connections and community that you have, plop you in a new place, you have to start all over again. So what I'm trying to get at about this idea is the disruptions to your social biome are really about rebalancing the ways that we're connected in our world, not necessarily achievement-oriented, one solution, one way to do it right.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's such a great analogy. When you do fall in love, right, and you have this partner in your life, and let's just say you start having kids, then all of a sudden your social biome changes up.
Absolutely.
Now you've got other mothers, other fathers. Now new kids are in your life and they're taking over your entire home, actually. And then you've changed that up. At the same time, your original friends, I think one of the biggest and most important messages with regard to that change up of ecosystem when you do fall in love is that, okay, we're going to forgive you for the fact that you're just like totally in love and you're Velcroed to this person and your life has changed. Okay, we're good with that. But at some point, there's a return to some level of homeostasis.
You got it.
And there has to be, because it's like, well, we're going to have a wedding now and I need all my friends. Oh, the ones I've been neglecting all this time. No, so I think that you just sort of eventually come back. I also think that people are forgiving of that because A, they've probably gone through it themselves. And B, they're reasonable people, but it still kind of hurts when the usual meetup at the coffee shop isn't happening because you just took off with your partner or whatever the heck is going on. So I can see this as a very dynamic, changing, and challenging ecosystem. Just very much like, you know, I'm a conservationist in a big way, and believe it or not, when I was at Berkeley, I did pre-med, you know, the usual thing is like cellular biology, snore. And, you know, I did all of that. But at the same time, I got permission to do a double major. And I thought, oh, she's going to add in anatomy or something. I said, no. I like sick people and I like sick trees. And so I kind of went with conservation of natural resources. So when I saw the word ecosystem constantly mentioned, I kept going back to all of those analogies and how that works, even with the seasons, how it changes, and even with geographic locations and with the fauna and the flora. And it's beautiful mix of challenging, changing processes that keep going on. And then I applied it to what you were saying, and I was finding myself really getting engaged with this issue of communication and the glue that really holds us all together and that contributes to our ability to be optimally well, mentally, physically, spiritually. And you can't do that without all of this. And I love the fact I'm always all about new ways to redefine the narrative. And instead of like, and we should all communicate so well and, you know, snore. Now you're saying social bio, ooh, it's so contemporary. It's such a great phrase. And I think about it a lot now. So congratulations to you. You messed with my brain.
You made my day, Pam. This is wonderful to hear that you enjoyed it so much.
We hope
to be this exciting for others. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now you said we're living in an age of interiority, not superiority. What is that?
Yeah. So this is actually a dynamic that I'm really excited to share with everyone here, because that in the book, this was based on some articles I wrote for the Wall Street Journal and work that I've been doing about this idea that we're kind of in a social decline period. You may have heard that people are feeling more lonely, but it also is the case that for over 25 years, people are spending less of their free time in social engagement with one another. Some of the things that have the steepest decline are things like going out to parties or hosting parties, visiting friends or family in their own home, or inviting people into your home. But even talking to people in your own household has gone down. People are just not doing it as much as they used to. So what we talk about is that as we sort of go into this period of time, and the COVID pandemic kicked us further down that sort of route.
But the trend was already there.
The trend was already there. That's right. But it really kicked us down really even farther. We really got to the point where we started looking at justifications and ways of understanding our lack of being social as being right. Our lack of being social as the right thing to do. It's permissible. It's even better. So I don't know about you, but I don't know if you remember a couple of years ago where people were talking about how actually it's an introvert's paradise, right? That it's sort of introversion was having this moment where introverts were uniting and sort of solidarity saying, isn't it great now that we don't have to go out and communicate with other people? Right. I've seen little t-shirts actually at stores that my teenagers shop on that says like, friends don't make other friends leave their house. There's a lot of this sort of rewarding messages about don't be social and almost glorify not being social. But we can also see this in other trends which are fascinating, which are things like self-care versus self-improvement. So self-improvement movement was really based on the idea that I want to improve who I am so that I can have better relationships with people, so I can achieve better at work, so I can be a better parent, a better partner, a better friend. The self-care movement is I need to retreat within myself to be less dependent on other people and to offer other people less because their toxicity is interfering with my happiness. So this is also a marker of the age of interiority. We are living at a time where there is almost a glorification of what it means for us to be inwardly focused, self-focused, and socially unavailable to other people. And what's fascinating about this is that there's some evidence historically that this is a pendulum that swings back and forth, that there are periods of time where people say the holy, the adventurous, the people who are truly enlightened are alone. You're that solitary, individualistic sort of like they're held up in society as being a person who's really got it figured out. Then we go through other periods of time where people are like, the people who are socially and isolated are deviant. They're a problem. They're the cause of difficulties. What people need to be is communally focused. We need to be among other people. We need to be social. We need to be open. We need to be caring for each other. And this pendulum shifts over periods of time. What Andy and I are arguing in the book is that we're actually going through a period of time where we've shifted really far into an age of interiority, where everything in our world is telling us, don't be social. It's not worth it. It's not worth your time. You're exhausted. Stay home. People invite you to a party. Make an excuse. Don't show up because all of those things are justified. So we're not standing in judgment of those things to say that's bad or that you're making the wrong choices. There are plenty of very good arguments about why self-care is necessary, particularly in a very high-stress environment. What we're saying is it is harder these days than usual to find the opportunity and time to be as social as we should be for our own well-being.
Well, I think that I think social media has not helped this because, you know, by definition, it's like, oh, I got tons of friends. You know, I have 1,000 followers on X and my Facebook is just full of great comments. Like, what? Wait a minute. What happened to eyeball contact at a coffee shop and just hanging out and having a good laugh? And I think that that became uncool. And I still, obviously, I've balked that entire thing. I said, no, I need a human being. Why? Because I'm a smarty pants, Jeff. You knew that. And that is, I know the research and the longevity research, you know, the long Harvard study, for instance, of the men at
the Harvard Hopkins study, you're right.
Yep, absolutely. And what it clearly showed was the number of friends you have at the age of 50 literally predicts your longevity. So if you've got no friends, okay, that's not looking great. It's not like you need to have 50,000 of them,
no.
Right? No, it's just a critical mass of people that you can rely upon to kind of be there. If you gave them a call, they're on the next plane. They're there for you and that type of thing. But that takes work.
It sure does.
You know, it takes work to communicate. It takes work to maintain these meaningful relationships. And I think a lot of them fall by the wayside during all of these times in our life that you've described so beautifully, when we're up to our eyeballs and work and professional training, you know, and it just keeps going on. And then the tragedy is the fallout. And that is you've dropped those friends. And I don't know. I mean, I don't see that as hopeless. I see that as, you know,
not
reuniting. What do you think?
Well, I think this isn't hopeless at all. The number of voices who are working in unison to get people to be concerned and aware that their sociality makes a difference in their longevity or well-being is greater than I've ever seen in my career.
Really?
We're in a place where there are more people talking about this, more people aware of it than ever before. We're entering into a time, I think, where people are talking about social health in a similar way we talk about physical health and diet. So we're bringing it to people's attention that these are things you can do to actually live a better life and that you can live more robustly, more fully, more healthily if you care for other people. The great Robert Putnam has a terrific quote that I really, really like on this. And he says that basically we have to convince people that being obligated to one another is a good way to live. But it's really hard to do that. Convincing people that it's a good idea to feel obligated to each other is a difficult argument right now. And a lot of people are just not buying it for a lot of different reasons. But you bring up one of the things I think is important is what are the barriers, right? Why are people lonely? What are going on with that? And there's a couple things I want to draw attention to. One of the things we talk about in the book is according to the data from the American Time Use Survey, the strongest correlate of time spent socializing is not necessarily time in front of a screen, it's time at work. The people who have the least time to be available and present for one another, people who are working multiple jobs or working long hours. And what's interesting is this very nicely aligns with research that also came out of Harvard recently, not from the Harvard's men's study, but another study that found that when you ask both adolescents and their parents, what was one of the number one things for them personally that was interfering with their ability to be as social as they would like, they call it the grind, right? That's what young folks would call it, right? I feel like I'm always needing to achieve. I got to do better at school. I got to take care of all these different things. And for adults, their parents, they were saying, I'm working too many hours, I'm too obligated, I got so many things I have to do. What's fascinating is it seems we're living in a moment of cultural burnout where we really feel like we just do not have anything left to give. You know, you can't bleed a stone, right? There's just no much more, how much more difficult it is to make time for one another because of these grinds created by work conditions and stressors and by the expectation of constant achievement and constant sort of working towards being successful. So I think if we take these tensions sort of as kind of indicative of where we're at in the world, it makes sense that people would retreat internally, right? They become more interior. They become kind of embracing of self-care because they're like, I ain't got time for other people. I might as well make time for myself.
And I'll optimize that. It's interesting, Jeff, the book is so timely. And I'm sure that you know as an author and as a fellow author that timing is everything.
I hope so. I hope so.
No. The reason why, I mean, think about it for a second. Right now, we have a lot of people who are losing their jobs.
Yeah.
And the jobs are changing, and it just, there's a huge economic shift going on, both in private industry as well as government, no question about it. So we've got a lot of uncertainty, a lot of stress. We've got all of this stuff going on, needless to say. So when you say, hey, it's all about going to work, well, then I thought about all the remote people. It's like, oh no, you know, it's like, when's the last time you had a really meaningful relationship with someone who's a little square on a screen?
On a Zoom feed, right?
Yeah, just like little tiny thing, you know, you're waving away and everything. And so then you have to sit down and be creative about where are the meaningful relationships actually going to emerge? Where are they? And I think that in today's narrative, things have changed rather substantially. And now we're also looking at the value of a college education. When we see that, well, obviously, what there are certain professions, certainly mine as a physician and yours as an academician, that absolutely require that you have the physical presence in the university and that you follow a trajectory. And that's all required. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. No question about it. But there are a lot of people now sitting back saying, you know, what am I really getting out of accumulating $200,000 of debt that I'll never be able to pay off? How am I redefining my own meaning and purpose in life? And this is why a lot of the trade schools, you can't even get in. The waiting lists are endless. This is why a lot of young people are saying, I'm going to be an entrepreneur right now. And I'm going to, you know, I'm smart. I can code. I could do this and that. And then they're starting companies and being quite successful. I mean, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, neither of them ever graduated from college. So I think that it's interesting. Where do you find these relationships? Usually it was like, you know, pretty straightforward. You go to work, you make all those friends. Go to the university, you make all those friends. Now everything's like shook up. And there's no longer a foundational feeling to this. It's like, I can guarantee myself, you know, a ton of networks in a particular environment that is already going through earthquake-like levels of change. What do you think of that?
Yeah. So I read a couple articles, one for the Wall Street Journal as well, about making friends at work and why that's difficult or the consequences of our current shift to remote work. So up most recent statistics that I've heard, we are still at a rate of double the number of people who are working remotely than did in 2019. So although that went to like quadruple during the pandemic, it's since kind of leveled out, especially with a lot of the efforts to bring people back into the office place. Well, what we know is that in middle age, the number one place that people meet friends is at work. Prior to that, though, is school, right? So that kind of trajectory of meeting friends when you're in school, particularly middle school and high school, is still well intact. And the majority of people who have long-lasting friendships made them in their young adulthood or their adolescence. That's still true. It also seems to be the case for those who do go to college, but also people who like join the military or otherwise, they develop those close, long-lasting friendships in their early, late teens and early 20s. And that's still true. What's tricky here is we are now entering a period of time where the time between when you actually kind of arrive at your career status and where you actually sort of move jobs as much as people do more and more, that time is extended. So you can't really count on the sort of period of stability and sort of repetition that friendship allows to grow. So one of the studies that I've done that's got quoted a whole bunch is how many hours does it take to make a friend? And it takes just about 50 hours just to go from acquaintance to casual friend. But if you're always picking up and moving to a new place, if you're always looking out the door for the next opportunity, you're just not spending the kind of time you need to make friends. In the remote work category, one of the things I mentioned in this Wall Street Journal article is that, as you say, you know, it's really unfamiliar and weird to try to have social friendly conversations through Zoom before a meeting starts. If you think about the way that all of these apps are developed, they're meant for maximum efficiency and very, very little sociality. Right? Not only are most people not really paying all that close of attention to what's going on, especially if it's a larger Zoom call, But there is none of that little sort of chit-chat on the side before the meeting gets started or as you walk out the door to see how things are going. There's no of that kind of like, you know, they usually call it water cooler talk. However, I don't work at a place with the water cooler, so that doesn't really relate to me. But it's all been stripped away, and all that's been left is the meeting. There's really good evidence that says that the more time that people spend in meeting, the more time that they feel lonely at work. So I think that all of these changes, whether it's remote work, whether it's the fact that people are working more jobs, whether it's the fact that you have a lot of sort of changes in how many different jobs you're supposed to have or how many times you're supposed to go back to higher education, or as you mentioned, sort of training for other jobs that you might get, all of these things, as I mentioned, are both great for you personally, potentially, but also really harmful for your social biome. So what's fascinating about this is that our whole concept here is that it's neither a good nor a bad thing when we think about how our life events shift our interdependent relationships with one another. It's just where we are. That is the nature of our current society, which means that you personally have to take more responsibility and work harder to build those relationships because it's harder than ever to maintain them.
All right. When we come back, I'm going to ask Jeff to explain why connection and restorative solitude are linked. The Her Podcast is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, all rooted in nature. In addition to women's multivitamins, Solaray, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y, is presenting the new Her Life Stages products, providing support for the menstrual years, including PMS, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause, and even libido. This integrative holistic approach has a woman's back throughout her entire life journey. To learn more about Her Life Stages, you've got options. You can run on over to your local health food store or check it out at Whole Foods, Sprouts, Amazon, or scroll over to Solaray.com and use promo code HER20 for 20% off your purchase. Women, Solaray's got your back. And we're back. All right, Jeff, connection and restorative, what is restorative solitude? And wait a minute, you just said not to be alone. What's going on here? What's cool? What's not?
Yeah. One of the things in the book that I really love talking about, this is an area of focus that I've had for several years, is that we kind of go in and out of periods of being social and periods of time alone. Everybody knows this. In fact, a lot of folks talk about how important it is on those first like moments of the day to be quiet and no one talk to me, I need my coffee, right? That's the kind of our cultural joke that we have going on. But there are other times in the day where we really like to have that peace, that quietude, that sense of solace in our solitude. And those things actually are restorative. So what we know is that as people get kind of overwhelmed socially, there's too much, they seek retreat. They seek some time for themselves. They seek some time away from others. And that this time alone is necessary in order to rebuild your kind of social energy in order to be back and being social again. What we also know is that the longer time people spend being alone, from studies that have been done on older adults and younger adults alike, the more likely is when they return to being social that they can stand longer periods of being social. So if you have a lot of time to restore, then you also are more able to be social for a longer period of time. The one I think about too is like whenever I have a social obligation in the evening, something that might have to do with like a work event that I need to go to or a party or something like that, I like to take some time before I go out just to be alone. Clear my head, clear my thoughts, lay down, read a book, just check out for a while. And so I can actually feel truly disconnected so that when I go back into that social atmosphere, I'm a little bit recharged. I can do it again. So one of the things that Andy and I found really fascinating in our original study on the social biome is we found that how people feel about whether they're lonely or having a satisfying life in the big picture had a lot to do with how they felt when they were alone. When people were alone, said, I feel good. I've had plenty of social interaction today. I feel well nourished. When I'm alone, I'm recovering from a lot of being social. They actually tended to be people who are not lonely at all, right? When people were alone, but said, I wish I had more people in my life. I'm not alone by choice, right? I'm alone because I have to be because I don't have anybody, or the people who I'm reaching out to aren't getting back to me. Those folks tended to actually have pretty bad global well-being, right? They just weren't feeling really good. And this makes sense. Our time alone carries over from what we did before, and it also prepares us for what to come. So one of the things that Andy and I want people to think about a little bit more critically is that when people spend time alone, the best way you can possibly spend that time is to actually let yourself fully disengage. So we recommend things like taking a little bit of a digital break, right? Put your phone aside, especially for working adults. Don't respond to every one of those email. If you can, don't return texts from work or otherwise. Truly be alone and kind of acquaint yourself with that silence. Don't immediately turn to social media and get wrapped up into the next big thing or the most worrisome thing. I'm not saying don't spend time watching movies or reading books or whatever you do to kind of unwind. That's fine. What I'm saying is, when you're not being social, continue to embrace that lack of sociality so that you can have time to renew and restore.
I'm thinking about a lot of this as you're talking. I'm about ready to hop on a plane tomorrow to Washington, D.C., which before I moved to Florida a year ago was my home in the D.C. area up in Maryland. So I'm going to be back in the hood and I'll be very close to the White House. So I know the area extremely well. I'll be presenting at a science meeting. And so you know what I do in my mind? When I read this whole issue of the connection between the ability to keep that communication and all the social biome communication and then restorative solitude, I say to myself, okay, I'm going to be up to my ovaries in this meeting. I mean, there's just no question. There are people all over the place and whatever, and it's going to be one of those things. But then I say, but I'm from here. I know what's close to this hotel. And so it's the cherry blossoms and the basin. Real close by.
I lived in D.C. for a little while, too. It's beautiful.
There you go. It's gorgeous. And so, you know, in the White House, a couple blocks away, and you've got that whole area where you could just walk endlessly. So already, first thing I packed, my walking shoes. And then I also know that I have a really good friend who's going to be at the meeting. And so that individual is going to accompany me sometimes when I do my walking, having a moment, getting the heck out of a hotel. I'm an outdoor person. I'm an outdoor athlete. Being in a hotel is close to a nightmare, but you know, the things you do for love. So already what I'm doing is restorative solitude centric. And I have where I'm going to meditate. I meditate every day. Where I journal every day. You know, you and I are both writers. So it just, for me, it just primes the pump for the writing that we do. And my life is sort of in a different homeostasis that way versus people who just sort of throw themselves at the meeting. They end up overeating, over drinking, spending way too much time with people, collapsing at nighttime, rinse and repeat in the morning. And it's all horrible. Now, been there, done that. That's how I know. We've all been there, epic failures. And now I just feel as though I have so much more control when I really am more intentional about this restorative solitude. For that matter, I'm like ridiculously protective of that time. And I'll either come up with excuses why, you know, that 7 a.m. breakfast, you know, no, it's not happening. I'm going to be walking outdoors. I'm going to just do a walking meditation or whatever I'm going to be doing. And I've just learned to kind of manipulate and make it work for me over the years. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I like the way that you use the word intentional too, because I think a lot of what, you know, Andy and I are talking about in our book is the idea that any one of the strategies we offer may have come naturally to you. You might be a person where talking to strangers is something you're comfortable with. You never even thought of it. You're like, I didn't even know that I was doing that. That's just something that comes natural to me. You might be naturally a person who's able to regulate their social time with their time being solitary. You might be someone who naturally is really comfortable in having more in-depth or more high disclosure conversations, which are all tips that we offer at the end of the book for how to improve your social biome. But our goal is to have people bring a level of intentionality to their social relationships so that they can actually live in a social biome that's more thoroughly nourished. And for some of us, that came naturally. And you probably don't even read any of the book. You don't need to read my book. You already know it. But for some folks, they might actually need to kind of have a sense of, well, you know what? Maybe I need to be more forgiving of myself. If I need to pull within myself and not go too hard, or I'm already overextended, restorative solitude can be healthy for me. On the other hand, a story I heard recently I was really compelled by is a young man who was in therapy talking about why he felt like he really didn't have close friends in his life. And the realization that he had in that therapeutic encounter was the idea that he wasn't being a close friend to his friends. He wasn't inviting his friends to disclose. He wasn't listening when his friends did bring up more intimate topics. He was joking them off or laughing about them or giving people a hard time, because that's a lot of the ways that young men talk to each other. And when he learned that part of what it means to have good friends is to be a good friend, that awareness allowed him to create an opportunity to be a better listener, to be have more meaningful conversations with other people, and grow the friendships he had. So I don't think that Andy and I are providing sort of like some sort of keys of wisdom that no one has ever discovered before. But I think what we're trying to do is to make people have intentional steps towards growing better relationships in their life through recognizing the places in their own life where they need to have growth, and they can even also nourish the people and the relationships they have right now.
Add this to your little repertoire of marvelous tools here too. And that is what I love to call the cleanses. All right. So what's a cleanse? For me, I already know that when I fly back home to Florida on Saturday after some intense days here, right, I'm going to have a cleanse. What is that cleanse? It is my dog, Max. He is a black German Shepherd. And what we do is a cleansing walk. Nobody bothers me. I don't have my cell phone. I rarely ever use it when I'm walking with him anyway. But as I'm walking by the lakes and everything is peaceful and I'm seeing all the new goslings, the Canadian geese have made babies here right and left, and the ducklings and back. That's all I think about. It's a cleanse. It's like,
that's wonderful.
You know,
that sounds really nice.
I've had all the people I can handle, and it went well, networked, wonderful relationships, made some new friends, all good and everything. But there's got to be, well, there's that word, the B word, a little balance here.
Absolutely.
There's got to be a little bit of yin and yang here. And so I just, you know, everyone's got to cleanse. Some people just curl up with a book.
Yeah.
Other people binge Netflix for a little bit just to get people out of their brain. And I mean, whatever it takes, it's just got to be something that does not involve self-destruction. You know, lighting up a pack of cigarettes is not the way to go, right?
Yeah.
That type of thing.
I think that what you're saying is right on. And then one of the messages that we try to deliver is what you need really depends on where you start. So these are the suggestions that we offer are not universal. They're not going to apply to everybody equally, because it really depends on where it is that you're lacking and where the places you already are well nourished. So you wouldn't recommend a probiotic necessarily to every single person out there, but boy, are they important when you've had an antibiotic put into your system. So you have to think about the idea of what you need really depends on what's lacking. And I wouldn't necessarily go out and say everybody needs to follow these 7 steps perfectly in every order and there's a perfect recipe at all. Because a lot of folks, I imagine, who are your listeners, especially if they're listening to your advice over the years, already know these things. But this is a framework, a way of understanding how all these things come together in an ecology of our social lives.
Do women do this differently? Do they have a different ecosystem than men? Come on now, when it comes to communication, because you've written books about interpersonal relationships here. And my feeling is that the answer is yes. You know, we do everything differently. And I'm not going to say one's better than the other. I'm just saying that we just tend to do this a little differently. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that one way of thinking about this is to kind of thinking about strengths and weakness sort of in our relationship. So I published a paper a while ago about friendship expectations, so gender differences and friendship expectations. And there were 2 really interesting findings about this. The first was is that men and women tended to both really want to have friends who were trustworthy, who liked them for who they were, has showed commitment to that relationship. They really, really wanted really close friends in a similar way. But women were more likely to have self-disclosure and talk as a major kind of feature of what amounted to have an ideal friend. And so if you can think about it, both men and women want really strong friendships, but the route they use to get there might be slightly different. Another study that I did on the same topic, though, that found that women were more likely to be disappointed with their friends than men were, because they tended to have higher expectations of what they expected from friends. So we're more
of
likely.
Of course.
Like, yeah.
Of course.
So you failed me, you didn't come through for me or otherwise, where a lot of times men's expectations were easier to meet, which meant that they both were getting less from their friends comparatively, but were more satisfied with what they got because their expectations were lower. So I think that a lot of this can be brought into the idea is when you're in a culture in which that, you know, you have mainly same-sex friendships and people still generally have mainly same-sex friendships, you try to fit the expectations of that culture. And I think that that's partly why that men and women tend to behave differently in friendship.
Hmm. And then as a very last point here, because honestly, I am so loving this. If you don't, you've got to get this book, The Social Biome. This is so cool. And it'll really open up your eyes to your own reality about how you deal with friendships. Because I'm telling you right now, lay down that solid foundation. And BTW, by the way, it's never too late. Never too late. You can make so many friends, but you know, you got to do, as Jeff said, you got to work it. There's work involved here. You want a good friend, you got to be one, and you got to put yourself out there, and maybe you're going to be rejected once or twice. So you know what I say to that? The world didn't end, you know, move on. Just keep looking ahead and move on. So speaking of hope, hope is an interpersonal phenomenon. So why is this important in the social biome?
Yeah, my co-author Andy wrote this chapter. I think it was just a brilliant contribution to the book and such an important message for us to end on, right? Hope in others. We need to live in hope of one another. And one of the quotes he has in there that I was really personally very moved by was this idea that we are the holders. We hold each other's hope in each other. So your hope for your future, your hope for your ability to grow and change as a person, I make possible through caring for you, through investing in you and helping you see your way through. And hope from Andy's research has really found that there's both pathways. So you have to have like a plan to get there, but you also have to have some sort of agency. You have to feel like you're able. And what relationships do is they make us feel like someone outside of ourselves believes in us and makes us believe that we too can live in hope for a different tomorrow. And that's where the interpersonal communication comes through. He's found this in families who are from kids who are from DACA families. Immigration status is uncertain. He found this in young adults. He's found this in romantic relationship partners. We are the holders of one another's hope. And through communication, we can actually make that hope a possibility and a reality.
I think that that's one heck of a way to end this, because I'm a realistic optimist. I don't know. I made that up. Does that make sense?
So I think I would too. So I'm going to agree with that.
You know, seriously, I'm not a happy wappy, like everything's groovy. Gosh, showing my age. So realistically optimistic, you know, if something funky happens, I'll sit with it for a while, may not be happy, you know, but then eventually I pivot. And I usually pivot by moving forward and saying, okay, there's a life lesson here. Everything happens for a reason, blah, blah, every cliche you can. But basically, you move forward. And I think that this is where this hope issue comes in. And the fact that the hope actually comes from interpersonal relationships. It's not like, well, I just sat here in a corner and I generated all the hope in the world without a single other person impacting upon this at all. No, that's not the way this works. Generally speaking, Anita, you need interpersonal relationships, a strategy, a network, support. You don't need 6,000 people. You just need enough. You know, it could be two people, three. Who knew? And then all of a sudden, you're off and running. And that's one of the reasons why I love that four-letter word, hope, because it really drives and fuels people to be able to get up in the morning and live a life of meaning and purpose, because they have the hope of achieving some of those objectives and goals. Make sense?
Yeah. I don't think there's a better way to end.
I did that deliberately.
That's why you're the pro. That's why you're the
Jeff, I'm just saying, this was such a fabulous interview. Everyone, clearly we have been talking to Dr. Jeffrey Halls, and he is the co-author of a book that I just think the world of, and you will too, because of course you're going to go out and buy it. It's called The Social Biome, and the subtitle is How Everyday Communication Connects and Shapes Us, because it does. Okay, so I'm thinking of the microbiome, the gut microbiome. I always call the bacteria and viruses that hang out in our gut, there's like 11 trillion of them or something ridiculous.
Yeah, something ridiculous.
I call them friends with benefits. Okay, and so they're our little friends, and we're interacting beautifully together, and we have our own little homeostasis, and it works. And so literally, we're communicating at the cellular level. So there's your beautiful analogy. And now we're talking about, you know, ramping this up to our communication with friends, coworkers, the guy next door, a total stranger, loved ones, is just the whole thing. And honor that ecosystem. Most importantly, run on out and get The Social Biome by Dr. Jeffrey Hall and Andy Marola. Absolutely.
You got it. Great guy. Great call.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Really meant a lot to all of us. And I want to also thank my sponsor, Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, rooted in nature, and the new Her Life Stages products. Scope it all out at solaray.com. Her Life Stages. And everyone, take a moment and leave us a review, because we love to hear from you. We just sit around waiting to hear all that critical feedback. And this has been a production of Podcast Health. And remember, please, this is your little reminder every week. Your time in this world may be limited, but the things you can do with that time are not. So get on out there and seize the day. A little bit of carpe diem. Thanks for listening, everyone.